This is Wide Margins, Episode 12, Opaque King. I want to start off talking about the title for this episode. I've changed it a couple of times. Originally, the title was going to be The Man Who Refused to Be King. Because I've always looked at Gideon as this hero who was humble in the end. He got a rough start, kind of insecure. He was threshing grain in a wine press because he was afraid of the Midianites, but he rose up to be this great military commander through the power of God. He requested a number of signs, but he eventually strengthened his faith to the point that he could lead God's people to victory. He had some rough times in the last episode that we talked about, but he's coming out okay because when the Israelites approach him and offer him not just to be king, but to build a dynasty on his family, Gideon says, "No, I won't rule over you. My son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." But that simple interpretation of Gideon as the humble servant of the Lord doesn't match the context in which his story is couched. And this is one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast, and one of the reasons I wanted to look at tough texts like Judges, because with time to go through this carefully and with the opportunity to use this special, more intimate format, I see things I've never seen before. And that's the case with this particular episode in Gideon's life. I'm not so sure he's that humble servant we saw before. There are problems with that interpretation. And I do this very carefully. I want you to know that. I want you to know that what I'm about to say is tempered with humility and uncertainty. I'm going to tell you my conclusions, and I'm going to support them to the best of my ability, but I in no way sit here saying I've figured Gideon out, because I haven't. He's just as puzzling to me today as he always has been, probably more so. But I want you to think carefully about it, because what I'm going to say in my conclusion about who Gideon really was, so far as we can tell from the text, not only challenges what we learned in Bible class about him, but also humanizes him and gets us to look more closely at ourselves and our own insecurities and our own ambitions and desires. It challenges those and also keeps us from settling for the wrong king. This is a story about the opaque king who wasn't all that he could have been. Robert Bly wrote a book called Iron John. It's an analysis of a Grimm's folktale called Iron John, and it's about leadership and about men. And in the book, Bly posits three kings. He says there are three kings. There's an upper king, a middle king, and a lower king. The upper king is the sacred king, the invisible king, the ultimate king. And Christians would interpret that to be God, of course. So would Gideon. Then the middle king is the political king, the ruler, the president, the governor, whatever. Maybe even the father. But the political king is there for a very important reason. He's there to be transparent or receptive to the upper king. In other words, the people below the middle king, the political king, ought to be able to see the upper king, the sacred king, through this political king. That's his role. He is to be transparent to the king above. The final third king is the lower king. This is the inner king within all of us. The Bible says that we've all been created in the image of God. We have God's image in us. We have been made independent creatures who can make our own decisions. The inner king is that ability to independently stand when nobody else stands with you. It's your faith, it's your conviction. But you can't develop the inner king within you without the middle king, the father, the king, the president, the leader, the elder, the leader in the church, the preacher. If that king is not transparent and allowing you to see the upper king, you are unable to develop the inner king within you. I think Bly's idea of three kings is very helpful, especially in studies like this when we're looking at flawed leaders like Gideon or any leader. We can see the true role of what Gideon is as a judge of Israel. We're looking at our fifth judge now, so we're more than halfway through our judges. And we see Gideon here, and we're going to evaluate him by this three-king idea. Was he acting as he should to be transparent and receptive to the sacred king so that the Israelites under him could see who was really above them, the ultimate king above them? Picking up where we left off, Gideon has defeated the Midianites. He has slain the Midianite kings. There has been a great victory. The oppression is over. We're at the top of the cycle we've been following throughout the book of Judges. And the men of Israel come to Gideon with a proposal. Judges chapter 8, verse 22 says, "Rule over us, you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian." And Gideon's response in verse 23 is, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." I've always looked at that, as I said at the top, as an admirable thing. And on the surface, it really is. And maybe it was inspired by pure motives. Maybe Gideon, according to the traditional interpretation of this, really was saying, "I'm not fit for kingship." Maybe he was asserting the theocracy, government centered on God, and rejecting the monarchy that would plague Israel later on, beginning in the days of Samuel, that would fall apart after Solomon when his son Rehoboam split the kingdom and it never was the same again. Maybe Gideon is in the spirit of what God wanted when God told Samuel, "They haven't rejected you, they've rejected me from being king over them." But when you put this in context, there are too many puzzling attitudes and behaviors of Gideon to make that the simple interpretation, in my view. Let me explain. What I think he may be saying here is giving a qualified acceptance, in which he's redefining the form of what a king is. I get this idea, by the way, from Dale Ralph Davis in his commentary on Judges. It's a really good commentary. I'd recommend it to anybody. It's really easy to read, but it's deep and scholarly at the same time. And Davis says he believes this is a qualified acceptance of their proposal. They say, "We want you to be a king. We want you to be like the other nations around us and rule us in a dynasty." And Gideon, knowing that's not right, may be qualifying and saying, "Okay, I'll be a king, but in reality, just realize God is going to be ruling through me. I'm going to be in the position, but God will be ruling through me, just so you know that." And then he starts acting like all the kings around them. Now, here's some of the things that trouble me about Gideon and about this interpretation that he rejects wholesale the idea of being a king. You back all the way up to the last episode and the way that he treated the inhabitants of Succoth and Penuel, his own people, and I'm not justifying their behavior. When Gideon's armies are famished, they should have provided them with sustenance and provisions. They were protecting these people, and they wouldn't help them at all. They were going to go with the winner, and they weren't sure Gideon was going to win just yet. If Midian won, they were going to back Midian. That's not the way God's people should behave. Still, Gideon came back with vengeance. He did not forgive, he showed no mercy on his own people, but he beat, flayed, I think is the term, the elders of Succoth with thistles and thorns. He went to a lot of trouble to punish them, and he tore down a temple in Penuel and killed a lot of Israelites. And then after that, you have his insecurity with the Midianite kings. He's caught these two kings, and they're giving him instructions on their own execution. He wants his firstborn son to execute them, kill them with his sword, I guess to harden the boy up. He's too young for that, and the Midianite kings see this, and they say, kill us yourself. And so he does. You know, maybe they thought, this boy is not going to kill us with the first cut, and this is going to hurt really bad. We're going to die, so let's let a professional killer like Gideon get the job done. Or maybe they were, you know, having fun, or maybe there was some cynicism here. I'm not sure, but Gideon doesn't seem to be in charge, even over the execution of the men who are giving him orders. These captives are telling him every move to make. And then you have this greed for the spoils of war. There's this statement Gideon makes, and then his men don't respond after verse 23, and Gideon keeps talking. Maybe there's a baffled silence there, as they never anticipated his refusing the offer to become king. But he says in verse 24, let me make a request of you. Every one of you give me the earrings from his spoil. For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. Ishmaelites, Midianites are synonymous in this text. And they said, we'll willingly give them. So they spread out a cloak and they threw all the spoil in there. And the weight of just the earrings they collected was 1,700 shekels of gold, which is a lot of gold. That doesn't count the pendants he collected from the necks of the kings and from the camels and some of the other things. He collected a lot of gold for himself on this occasion. Why did he do that? Maybe he was trying to placate the people who expected him to receive something. Kind of like when you go over to somebody's house and they've cooked a big meal and you're not really hungry, or you don't really like the way the food looks and you don't want to eat, but you go ahead and eat anyway, so you don't make the host angry. Maybe he was doing something like that. He didn't really want to take the gold, but he had to come up with something aside from being king to placate these people who were going to show gratitude one way or the other. I'm not sure. I just know that he took it, and what he did with it afterwards was not good. Not good at all, because you have this religious innovation in verses 26 and 27. It says that he took all of this gold from the spoils of war, and he made an ephod of it and put it in his city in Ophrah, and all Israel whored after it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. This is going to require a little explanation. First of all, what is an ephod? Well, if you read the old law, and you read Moses' instructions in particular in Exodus through Deuteronomy, you know that the priesthood had a special garb, especially the high priest. And part of that was this ephod, which was a breastplate, kind of like an apron that he would wear over his robes. And on the front of it, there were these 12 jewels representing the 12 tribes of Israel, and it served as kind of a bib inside of which were the Ummim and the Thummim, these mysterious objects that somehow aided the priest in inquiring of the Lord. It all has become lost. We have no diagrams of it. We have very little description of it, so it's hard to know what it was. But that was the ephod, and you would see, even into David's day, people stealing the ephod or getting the ephod so they would be able to inquire of the Lord. Some scholars believe that it could give only like a yes or no answer, work kind of like casting lots or something like that. We don't have any idea how it worked, but God ordained it for a short period of time to advise the priests in leading the people of Israel. That ephod was sacred. It was consecrated, and it was only to be worn by the high priest, only to be used by the high priest. As far as we could tell, the tabernacle in these days was located in Shiloh. Shiloh was the place where it's described in Joshua, in one place in Judges 18, and also at the beginning of 1 Samuel. So the evidence is pretty good that the ephod, the authorized ephod, was there. Now Gideon makes one, and I'm a little puzzled about what he actually makes too, because that's a lot of gold for a breastplate. How could somebody wear that much weight in gold? There are other opinions that he might have constructed some kind of golden image called an ephod because it might have had this prophetic ability, or it might have been the prophetic ability might have been attributed to it to answer questions. And so in that sense, it was the ephod, but it wasn't an apron or a breastplate or anything to be worn. We don't know what it was that he made, but we know that it wasn't official. It wasn't according to the law of Moses. It wasn't in the hands of the high priest. It wasn't at Shiloh where the tabernacle was. It was with Gideon in his hometown of Ophrah. This is a problem. I think you're starting to see what kind of problem it could be. And the text is very clear about the ephod. If it's not clear about Gideon and what he meant when he refused to be king, it said, all Israel whored after it, prostituted with it. This language of adultery, infidelity, unfaithfulness, and whoring is used throughout the Old Testament to indicate idolatry, choosing a false god over the bride, over God as bridegroom. And this is what they were doing. They were being unfaithful to God through an object, a religious innovation made by Gideon himself. It was a real problem. You add to that some other behaviors that suggest Gideon was, despite his refusal, trying to behave like a king. He sets up a harem, verse 30. He had 70 sons because he had many wives. And he had this concubine in Shechem who bore him a son. And listen to the name of the son, Abimelech. That may not mean a whole lot to you. It will after the next episode. Abimelech is a name that you see in other places in the Old Testament. You can see it in Genesis. Twice, I think, Abraham encounters an Abimelech. Or maybe it's Abraham encounters an Abimelech and Isaac does. I should have looked that up before I hit record. But it appears several times, almost like it's a title or a common name for a prince or a king. And the reason for it is the name literally means, my father is king. Now, some scholars have tried to get around this and reconcile it with Gideon's refusal to be king by saying that Abimelech assumed that name later, or the people gave Abimelech that name. But the text is very clear here in the language of verse 31 that Gideon called his son's name Abimelech. The verb called meaning appointed his son's name, Abimelech. It could even refer to a renaming after the boy grew and the potential began to show itself in Abimelech. Gideon assigned him to be successor to the dynasty, the throne. Again, I'm not sure. I don't want to be overly confident in this, but it doesn't appear that Gideon is refusing kingship totally as it seems on the surface. It seems that he's qualifying his position, saying, I'm not going to be a king in the regular sense. Let's be sure to recognize the Lord is ultimately king. Through me, he will be your king. He makes this ephod, and I want to talk about this for a moment. The one instead of the one at Shiloh. The one that was not authorized. Wasn't the official ephod enough? I think we all understand the behavior here, because we've all done this too. God has given us plenty of direction. He has authorized plenty of worship expressions, plenty of rituals, plenty of behaviors, plenty of revelation, and still we want more. What was once extraordinary and miraculous, for instance, the revelation of God as Himself in His Word, becomes commonplace to us because we've been richly blessed with it, and it's been a part of our lives. And when it becomes commonplace, we have to have more. We have to have the sensational. We become fanatics for religion instead of followers of Christ. That's exactly what's happening here with Gideon. It's what happened, and the language is very similar if you think about it. It's what happened with the Israelites when they came out of Egypt. They saw the Red Sea, they saw the 10 plagues, pillar of cloud by day, pillar of fire by night, and what do? Moses is up on Mount Sinai where it's thundering and something magnificent is happening, but it takes too long for them. They want some more extraordinary, they want to be enriched even more, so they give Aaron their gold and he obeys them, placates them by making a golden calf. They settle for a golden calf because it's something new, it's something everybody else is doing. They sell out. Here Gideon is placating his people, receiving gold, melting it down, making some kind of an image that becomes an idol for Israel and a snare to Gideon and to his family. Compromises his faith. And today we've been given the Word of God, inspired, every word of it, to lead us and give us all things that pertain to life and godliness, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 3, to equip us for every good work, 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 17. And still, we want more. So we start listening to our feelings. We start trusting emotions. We start justifying innovation, saying, God told me to do this, or the Spirit led me to do this. We reach out for more and we reach too far. We have our ephod making of our own, and it's just as much a snare to us as it was to Gideon. George Washington once refused to be king. It was after the Revolutionary War. His men had been fighting for 6 years without pay, and then they learned that Congress was bankrupt and they couldn't pay them. There was no hope of payment at all. They were broke, they had lost everything for this cause, the Revolutionary War. Angry, upset, not knowing what to do, a number of key officers approached their general, George Washington, and invited him to join an armed rebellion against Congress and allow himself to be set up as their king. This leads to maybe Washington's greatest moment, the thing for which we should respect him even more than his being the first president of the United States. He vehemently refused, and here are his words to his men. "Gentlemen, as I was among the first who embarked in the cause of our common country, as I never left your side one moment, but when called from you on public duty, as I have been the constant companion and witness of your distresses, it can scarcely be supposed that I am indifferent to your interests. But this dreadful alternative of either deserting our country in the extremest hour of her distress or turning our arms against it has something so shocking in it that humanity revolts from the idea. I spurn it as every man who regards liberty undoubtedly must." And with those words, Washington changed the course of history. He could have turned America into a monarchy. There's no doubt in my mind that he and his men could have succeeded in stopping the Constitution, stopping the democracy, and setting up just another monarchy in history. But he knew better. He knew what they had been fighting for. He had not forgotten his role. It was liberty that they were fighting for, and the focus is what kept him from accepting kingship. I want to talk about one more man who refused to be king. One that you, I have no doubt, regard as king. But on this particular occasion, the people who wanted to make him king had the wrong kind of king in mind. You see, they weren't looking for a king to reflect the upper king, the sacred king. They were just looking for somebody to deliver them politically from their Roman oppressors. Jesus had fed 5,000 men, not counting the women and children. And the people were amazed at how he had done this with only 5 loaves and 2 fish. And after 12 basketfuls were picked up that had been left over, people began to whisper, "This is indeed the prophet who has come into the world. This has to be him. This is the one that we read about in Moses. This is the one in the prophets. It's the Messiah," which means king. He's the one that will deliver us from Rome. John writes in John 6:15, "Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself." What was he thinking? I mean, Jesus himself claimed to be the Christ, the King. Weren't the people just offering him what he had came, what he had come to be? Not at all. They had the wrong idea of what a king is. They weren't looking for somebody who could show them the true king. They were just looking for another sorry, opaque king through whom they would not be able to see God. Meanwhile, Jesus was carefully focused on his mission to show people who God really was. Not that many people were paying attention. The night of his arrest, one of his disciples, Philip, got caught up in all of this talk about how Jesus would be the way and said, "Show us the Father, and it is enough." And Jesus turns to Philip and he says, "How can you say to me, 'Show us the Father, and it is enough'?" John 14:9, "If you have seen me, you have seen the Father." He was behaving just as a king on earth should behave. He was reflecting the true king. He was so transparent to the sacred king that anybody who looked at him could see straight to heaven to what God really was like. And so John begins his gospel account in John 1:18 saying, "No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known." Gideon did not show Israel the true king. If he had, he wouldn't have made that ephod they hoard after. And if he had, the people would have continued to follow God. But instead it's said that after Gideon's death, the people began this ruthless cycle again. After he died, they turned and whored after the Baals. The man named Jerubbaal, he who strives with Baal, had failed to persuade them away from that false god. They whored after the Baals, they made Baal-berith their god, and they did not remember the Lord their God who had delivered them from the hand of all their enemies on every side. And they did not show steadfast love to the family of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in return for all the good that he had done to Israel. I think this, beyond all other evidence, shows that Gideon, his refusal was not quite as honorable as it could have been. He had an opportunity to show people as a ruler, maybe not a king, the sacred king above that all of us must bow to. But he failed to do it. He did accomplish some good, though, and Judges chapter 8, verse 28 says, "The land had rest for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Sadly, that's the last time in the book of Judges you will read that the land had rest. That part of the cycle drops off. We continue to see Israel return to their sin, return to their false gods. We continue to see God graciously raise up deliverers after them. But no longer will you see rest in the land, because the people are, it's getting harder and harder for them to see God. And they're more and more focused on themselves, their political situation, their greed, their lust, their ambition. They were losing their sight of the king. These were the days when there was no king in Israel, but every man did what was right in his own eyes.